When most people hear the word posture, they think of trying to stand up straight, putting their shoulders back, or trying to hold themselves a little bit better. In this episode 138, I'm joined by Posture Eleanor Dalton, a posture therapist and coach who dismantles that idea entirely. Ellie reframes posture not as a static position, but as a dynamic reflection of how well your body moves. Now, your posture isn't something you fix by forcing alignment. It's a visible outcome of your movement patterns, habits, nervous system state, and the environment you live in. In this episode, we explore the difference between default posture and natural posture. We explore kind of why comfort isn't always a good guide, and how modern life quietly strips movement variety away from our bodies, and why pain rarely originates where it shows up. We go broader and wider. We talk self-care, hustle culture, data obsession, intuition versus metrics, and so much more. This episode really is a reminder that your body isn't broken, aging or failing you. It's adapting, and with the right inputs, it can adapt back to an optimal state. As usual, I've got some perks for you. I've used Lifeform yoga mats since pretty much when they began. They are, without doubt, I think, the best yoga mats. High quality, they've been imitated a lot visually, but you can't beat the feeling of their mat, the materials it's made of, and the fact they're a B Corp certified company that does so much for the yoga world and beyond. So code HUSLER10, HUSLER10, will get you 10% off any Lifeform yoga mat. And another little perk for you is for Vivo Barefoot. I think what you stand on, how you interact with the world around you physically, which is via through your feet, makes a massive impact on your posture and how you move in the world. And if you want to explore barefoot shoes, Vivo Barefoot is kind of the gold standard. And code HUSLER15, actually that's a lie. It's now code ADAMHUSLER15. We'll get you 15% off all Vivo Barefoot shoes. They've got kid shoes, snow boots, jungle boots, casual shoes, training shoes, running shoes. They've got it all. Have a little peek. Honestly,
when I heard the term posture coach, and I've been in the wellness world quite a while, I'll admit that I'd never heard of it before. I'd heard of things that can help you with posture, but I'd never heard of anyone who was so dedicated to posture. Now stalking you, I realize there's a whole world that is untouched. And there's some crossover with things that I have been educated, like Tom Myers and anatomy trains and alike. But to people including me, like, what on earth is a posture coach or whatever noun you want to refer to yourself as?
Yeah, okay, cool. So, well, thank you so much for having me. And a posture coach, I chose that term because I wanted to move away from posture therapist, which was the kind of qualification that I have. My qualification is I'm a postural alignment therapist or a postural alignment specialist. And I grew to dislike the word therapist because in my mind, it was a little bit disempowering. It was almost like people were coming to me and I had the answers. And as a therapist, I was sort of giving them the answers. Whereas what I liked about posture coach, and obviously I can go specifically into posture in more detail, but what I liked about the word coach specifically was that it, for me, was empowering. It's like I'm this person that's helping people work with what they already have, be the best versions of themselves. I truly believe that everybody has everything that they need inside of them, but they just need some guidance in helping them get them out of that. So it was just a semantics thing that I just resonate with being called a therapist anymore, and I wanted to be a coach because I wanted to see myself as a kind of guide, a friend, someone that's helping you along rather than telling you strictly what you should be doing.
So let's continue the explanation for idiots like me, because then when you say then posture coach, I'm thinking, okay, who needs good posture? Like, a model needs good posture. Like, people often say to me, which I realize is wrong now, oh, Adam, you got good posture, were you a dancer? And that's in my head then what I think of posture. Posture is someone that stands tall with a broad chest and makes the most of every possible vertebra to help them lengthen their torso. But that, from what I understand now, isn't necessarily what posture is.
I think that what people think posture is a part of what people like me define posture as. So if I say the word posture, 99.9% of people will just immediately thrust their shoulders backwards, chuck their chest up in the air, and stand really tall and rigidly. And that is a posture, but that is not your posture. That is, you're doing something, you're contorting your body in a shape, but that's not the way that your body actually naturally wants to hold itself. So when I'm talking about posture, when movement therapists like me are talking about posture, we're actually talking about your like state of being. It's very dynamic. Your posture is constantly in flux. You don't just have one posture, you have millions of postures that are available to your body. And we or I, most of the time, don't like to talk in like good and bad terms. I like to talk in stuck and mobile terms. So I don't like saying you have good posture. I don't like saying you have bad posture. But my job is helping to highlight to people where their posture might be stuck. And by unsticking their posture, by improving their movement patterns, and by restoring function back to all of their joints and their muscles, they will create more mobile posture for themselves, which will then mean that they just naturally hold themselves differently and show up in the world differently. So you, as a very long-term kind of yoga teacher and student, all of that stuff, in all likelihood, if we're going to use the term, you probably do have fairly good posture. Because your body has been tested in all of these different ways for such a long time. It would make sense to me that you've had that compliment
So
before.
you use the word there, natural posture. And from what I'm hearing, what you're doing is taking people from their default posture to their natural posture. So when I say default, or default is if you spent a lot of time hunching over desk, computer, phone, your default position is head hanging forwards, shoulders moving in an anterior direction. That's your default. That doesn't make it natural. And I will often say, when people are in Tadasana in yoga, okay, kind of mountain pose, standing tall, I make a point of saying that you need to do something. It's not just stand at a bus stop and slouch. It's actually, you need to do something to find the natural curve of the spine. Is that a way to see it? Natural versus default?
I love that. You're very good at asking questions, Adam. I'll give you that. I like your wording these. I can tell this is going to be fun. So totally. Most people, the vast majority of people, are born into a very similar molded body. Not everybody, but most people have a body that's fairly similar to the baby next to them, the toddler next to them. And what happens is our lives, everything that happens to us from the moment that we are born bears this impact on our musculoskeletal system. And so we start moving in different directions towards different default postures. Some people are showing up in the world with their chest puffed out, like proving a point, quite tense and masculine. Some people are cowering from the world around them and protecting themselves and slumping in on themselves. Some people are, extremely active and maintain quite good posture throughout their lives. Some people are sat at desks, like you say. We all go down slightly different paths. So our default postures, what is normal to us, changes throughout the course of our life. And my job is to help people realize that how they feel right now, their body's version of normal, isn't actually like where they could be. And it isn't necessarily the most optimal state for them to be in. And so it's about coaching people through corrective movements, through breathing, through calming the nervous system, through learning a new way of being, to try and track people back to this childhood body that they might have lost through the habits that they've had, the traumas that they've had, the accidents that they've had that's kind of led them astray. And to what you said about Tadasana, I, in my work, do not tell people to like stand up tall and pull your shoulders back like we would do in Tadasana. But what I do is I break the body down into all of its component parts so that we're creating better hip extension, better ankle dorsiflexion, better pelvic balance, better thoracic extension. It's like a mechanic going at the different parts of the body separately, and then we bring it back together so that the person will just stand up after a posture session and they won't feel like they have to pull their shoulders back or hold any tension in their body. They are just standing more naturally. They are more upright, they are more open, but they're not holding themselves there. It's just their new version of normal, which has been adjusted by the posture exercises that we've done.
Indeed, and I think it's worth clarifying there that like Tadasana isn't necessarily a way of being in life. It is an asana. Yeah. It is a pose that requires certain engagement, certain lengthening, certain positioning. It isn't necessarily how one would typically stand. It is an asana in itself. Now, I want to get a little bit more into kind of the tangible benefits here, because so we've kind of got rid of the idea that posture is about looking good. Okay, yeah. We've let that go. And then we've talked about kind of a neutral posture and what feels natural, and then kind of coming back to a childlike state. But playing devil's advocate, okay, which I'd love to do, I'm saying this, I don't believe in it, but I want to kind of get your answer, is if me slouching was natural for me and comfortable for me, and I don't need to be concerned with looking better when I sit or stand, this like me slouching over my phone feels comfortable, I could be here all day, why don't I want that then? What's bad about it? What maybe psychologically or is good about actually changing posture to a more childlike state? Why is it bad to slouch if it's nice to slouch and I don't care about looking good?
Because at some point, that lack of variety of movement and that lack of strength in your muscles will, you'll pay the price for it. So at some point, that dangling head and those stooped shoulders are going to cause you to have poor circulation because your blood vessels run down your arm and you've got nerves running down your arm and they might start getting impinged by that shoulder position. At some point, you might start getting headaches because your head's not designed to be in front of your shoulder. At some point, your breathing is going to be compromised. At some point, your digestion is going to be compromised. Everything inside of you, all of your organs are housed within your posture, and posture is basically your musculoskeletal system and the health of it. And so the reason that we have to challenge our posture is because our primal hunter-gatherer body has been designed through hundreds of thousands of years, if not millions of years of evolution, depending on where you want to decide humans came from, you know, how far back do we go? We have evolved to have these really challenging, varied lifestyles that keep our bodies in a certain condition. And if we didn't have that condition, we wouldn't survive very long. The modern environment allows us to not move so much. We don't have to. We don't have to get our calories and find our food and make fire and shelter and all of that challenging stuff. And so by allowing our bodies to kind of succumb to this floppiness, shall we say, that happens from muscular weakness, we are not the most optimal version of ourselves because we're not designed to be like that. We are designed to keep moving so much of the time. And the way that you hold yourself is a reflection of firstly how much you're moving, but with how much variety of movement you're challenging your body with.
I had a weird thought there. And so we're saying it's not about comfort. It's about making the most of your body and what it's designed to do from millions of years of evolution, without hundreds of thousands of years of evolution. It reminded me as a kind of an exaggeration is there is a tribe in Africa where they wear the kind of neck collars. I don't know if you've seen that. And the neck gets longer and longer. And equally, I think with geisha, there is a foot binding culture. I could be wrong there. But ultimately, the people that have spent decades, their whole life, making their neck longer, the moment you took their things away, everything would collapse. They would no longer be able to be a functional human being, as it were, because they have become comfortable with the thing around the neck. Same with the feet, okay? They've learned to walk on bound feet, but the moment you take the binding away, things would be a bit messed up, perhaps. So I guess that could be an extreme example, is just because you're comfortable, because you spent time doing things that are suboptimal, it doesn't mean that's right. It still means you're not allowing your body to be what it's designed to be.
Totally. I like completely agree with that. And I think for so many of us, you know, myself included, like I'm not perfect by any means, but the environment that we live in allows us to be so comfortable. We can get our phone and order a Deliveroo. We can, you know, sit on Amazon and get everything just brought to us. Whereas even a couple of generations ago, going to get some food may have required you to go outside and dig it up yourself. It might have required going down to your neighbors. 100 years ago, people didn't own their own cars. We didn't have like electric lights in all our houses. We didn't have heating. And I always say, it's like, imagine just those three things, like the convenience of food, heating and lighting, the changes that we have experienced in that technology in the last 100 years alone, how much movement that's taken away from our body, what we're not doing because of that. And it's this funny thing, isn't it? Like, we are humans who are wired for comfort because we are wired to conserve calories because in the environment that we lived in, they were hard to come by. But in the world that we live in now, we have to create a life that's less convenient for ourselves if we want our health to be as optimal as possible, because comfort, it might be nice in the short term, but long term, you will pay a price for that.
Mm. It's so interesting to think, and we don't need to talk about this in any depth, because it's a bit kind of going rogue, like what humans will be in the future. Because to yes. some degree, there is no survival of the fittest anymore at all. You could argue that, you know, if you have a bad diet, you're going to die younger, but by then you might have already had children and the like. So there is no real survival of the fittest. And I saw like a diagram, and I forget where I saw it, but it was of what a human being might look like in 200 years, like an accelerated evolution of like a head massively forwards, a rounded back. So maybe actually optimizing for a sedentary life.
Yes.
And it's so that's going to be the interesting thing is, are we fighting a battle that is going to be irrelevant, because ultimately in 100 years, all of us by default will be sitting on chairs all the time with a virtual reality headset on.
It is so interesting. And I think I know the exact one that you're talking about. And I believe it's also, it might be Wall-E, but there's one of the children's Spacey films where everyone's just on these kind of wheelchairs looking at screens.
It's Wall-E, yeah.
Yeah, I watched it years ago, and it is that kind of thing. And the question is, do we try and fight it or do we just accept it, right? But just because we might at some point start evolving for this new world, these new hobbies, this new life that is potentially in front of us and probably is in front of us, I still don't necessarily think it means that it's like optimal health. And to go back to what you said about the long necks or the bound feet, that might become your new version of normal. Your body might adapt to it. Your neck might get longer. Your feet might get stiffer, but it still doesn't mean that it's like the most comfortable or healthy way of being. And so I am of the opinion, but in 100 years time, if I'm still here, we can check to see if I'm right or wrong. Just because we can sit more in chairs and allow that to happen, and maybe our bodies will just adapt to the forward head posture and things, I personally don't believe that that will be the most exciting way of living as a human, because you're going to be so compromised. If your body is like that, you're not going to experience the joys of running around and having loads of energy and things like that.
But then I guess we're talking about things that we have zero control over, and we need to work out what's going to help us in the short term. So why yeah. might someone approach someone like you for your services? Why would they? I'm trying to kind of understand. I've never heard of anyone talk about a postural therapist. I've heard of people say, oh, this hurts, I need a physio, I need a doctor, back's a bit tight, let's do some yoga or whatever, or some Pilates, I need to work on my core, do some Pilates. I've never heard like posture coach in conversation. So at what point do you find that people are finding a need for your services? Not need for, because I'm sure everyone actually probably needs it, but at what point are people having the realization that they need and would benefit from your services?
So you're totally right. Absolutely everybody needs to work on their posture. You will never, ever regret the day that you start this work. Even from, you know, elite athletes, they're going to get better results by making themselves move more functionally and efficiently. To somebody who is bedbound with chronic pain, it's going to help them. Everybody in between benefits from better posture. But most of the time, people will come to me because, admittedly, they've tried everything else and they haven't found anything else that works. So I'm like that last chance saloon where they've thrown so much time, energy, money at everything else, the conventional system, physio.
Just before we carry on there, but why? Is it because, like, these people that tried everything else, what was their problem in the first place? Was it an injury? Pain. Was it pain? It was pain. Pain is the main cause, yeah.
So pain or injury, but I would say like typically it's people with chronic pain rather than the person that's broken their shoulder. It's somebody who has got like in inverted commas, mystery back pain or knee pain or shoulder pain or neck pain or whatever it might be. They've done all the conventional stuff and they have this intuition that perhaps the Western medicine model is missing something in terms of how they are treating them. So they are normally people who have this kind of intuition that where the symptom presents is not necessarily the root cause of the problem. So, the knee that hurts is not the problem. It's a symptom that there is a whole body movement problem, but we can't look at pain and injury kind of in isolation or the various bits of the body. We have to look at the body as a whole, and we have to realize that you can pull a string of the puppet somewhere and it will have an impact somewhere else. There's this butterfly effect that happens throughout the body, which I'm sure you will be like fully aware of. And so the people that kind of wash up on my shores, they've tried everything. They have this intuition that maybe it's not about having more steroid shots in their knee. Maybe it's not about strengthening their quad. Maybe it's not about having acupuncture. Maybe it's not about having a knee replacement in that knee. Maybe their whole body needs to work like the machine that it is supposed to be. We need this holistic view all over. And the way that posture therapy differentiates itself from other things is that it's this process of teaching people that if your big toe can't move properly, you're going to impact kinetic chains all the way up through your body, all the way up to your jaw and to your tongue. And therefore, your stiff big toe might be causing your chronic headaches or your neck pain. Your stiff hand might be causing your pelvic discomfort, your sacrum pain. And so it's people that think a bit differently are fed up of medication and surgery and sitting at the sidelines and feeling like there's nothing they can do for themselves. And they're open-minded to try this new thing that kind of goes against conventional wisdom or the conventional system.
In terms of then what sessions look like, okay, so they, I imagine, very bespoke to the individual. So I'm trying to imagine how it would look like compared to, let's say, an intelligent yoga class where in theory, in a yoga class, you're moving and unlocking the body, stabilizing where it's loose, strengthening areas that need it, opening where it's tight. How would this differ? Is it very specific drills? What does it look like a session once you've identified potentially certain symptoms of the problem?
So I'll talk about two things if that's all right. So firstly, one-to-one sessions is this is how I started and this is how my business ran for like most of the time, but I actually don't offer one-to-one sessions anymore. I have a membership platform. So I'll talk about the bespoke nature, but then I'll talk about how I've translated that into a kind of more group situation, how to make that work. So when I work with people one-to-one, yes, it's very bespoke. We're taking pictures of their posture. We're having a look at, okay, one shoulder's higher than the other, one hip's higher than the other, a foot's collapsed in, the rib cage is rotated. You have these various signifiers that they don't mean anything in isolation, but they're just giving you some clues as to what might be off. So, for example, if someone's got a hip hike, one hip higher than the other, it's very likely that they're not grounding or moving very well through that foot that of the leg that's higher. So the hip hike leg. Say it's the right-hand side, it's very likely that the right foot isn't moving well. And so I can kind of start making some guesses by just observing people's posture when they don't do anything else, just pictures.
One question before you come in with that. Are we saying, so in that example of the hip, like, so one side being like laterally higher, are we saying that that could, whether it's caused by their skeleton and their unique skeleton, or it's caused by behavior? Like I used to work with a hairdresser who constantly had one hip higher because that's just how he stood, with one leg turned out in external rotation. So are we saying that regardless of whether it is genetic or due to behavior, we could still come out with the same outcome and follow the same process?
Totally, but I think there's a lot less genetic stuff than people think. People might have had something for a really long time. You might be born with a psoas muscle that's kind of in contraction. If you've had like a traumatic birth, you might be born with one side of your psoas in contraction, which is going to make you seem like you've got a higher hip, and well, you will have a higher hip, a higher pelvis on one side. Just the fact that it was there when you were born doesn't mean that it's genetic
Or what I
and
mean, maybe your femur's longer. Like end of so rather than muscular tightness, just one femur won't be longer than the other, which would have the same visible result.
And again, I challenge how commonly that
Oh,
is
really?
prescribed to people. So
Okay.
I have had so many people come through my doors telling me that they have one leg longer than the other. We open up their hip, we ground them through their foot, and
Not
magically they
literally. Not, you check, you cut them open just to check.
But as in, I've heard that so many times, and I do appreciate there might be some people out there who have that. I've never met anybody in my practice where that's actually been the case. If we look at the muscles inside of them that are holding them in these different positions and we relax them and change them, the joints become balanced. And yeah, I'm yet to come across anybody in my work where I actually believe they have one leg longer than the other. They've been told that by people, but I personally just
haven't met. Yeah, I think it's very unlikely. I think what's probably more common is the spine. Like, we all imagine we've got this straight spine, but all of us are variations of kind of curvature of the spine, which then affects obviously level of the shoulders, etc. But I guess legs probably less common. And to be fair, a lot of people would never know, like, unless they have an X-ray, they would never have any idea.
Exactly. But typically when people are in pain, you know, because you've got to remember, like, the people that are showing up for me, they're in pain. So they've been through all these things where they've had the X-rays and the MRIs and stuff like that. So there's so much that you can start to guess from looking at somebody, but you don't have any answers from looking at somebody. Yeah. And then, so what I would do in a one-to-one appointment is get people doing what we call function tests, which is just like a fancy way of saying an exercise that you're looking for a specific outcome from. So, you know, like, you could say to someone, do child's pose. Let's put this in yoga terms because this might help your listeners sort of make sense of it. Do child's pose. What are we testing for in child's pose? We've got plantar flexion of the feet, we've got hip flexion, and we've got lumbar flexion are the kind of three main ranges of movement that are happening there. And if that person goes into child's pose and their pain goes down, wherever that pain may be, it's told us something about their muscular function. So I know, I can start to deduce that if we give that person more plantar flexion, more hip flexion, and or more lumbar flexion, their pain is going to start to reduce on the regular. So then I can prescribe them exercises that tackle those three ranges of movement. I might get them doing child's pose and nothing changes. Their pain might get worse. And therefore I go back to the drawing board and I'll say, well, their body didn't like the flexion. So what happens if I get their body extending? What happens if I get their hip rotating? What happens if I get their shoulder abducting or whatever it might be? There's this kind of like methodology of, it's just, you go through a little bit of a list and you find something that gives you and that client that nugget of hope. So what makes their pain go down? And then you create a posture routine based off very gentle exercises that tackle those specific ranges of movement that their body needs.
Nice. And that's, to be fair as well, something that I guess a good yoga teachers should do when someone approaches them with an injury. Like, my view is, if someone says to a yoga teacher, oh, I've got an injury, or this pose hurts, so, okay, let's work out, where does it hurt? What happens if you do this? Does it make it better or worse? What happens if you do that? Okay. Yeah. Now we know that. Do that more when you're watching TV. or do that more in a yoga class. Is do more of the thing that seems to ease it off. Yeah.
Totally. Like, it literally is that simple. And I totally agree. There are definitely yoga teachers who are able to do that. This is not like an exclusively thing. It's just, anybody can do it. But what I would say about yoga, and the reason that it's like different, I mean, there's a few different reasons, but the way that it's different is that with yoga, so many of the poses are like standing or moving through standing. You know, it's pretty fast, lots of the classes, and you have a lot of joints involved in each of the exercises. So even something like Tadasana, biomechanically speaking, is actually very technical because you've got all of the load joints involved. The more load joints you have involved in a movement, the more probability there is for that movement to go, in inverted commas, wrong. The more likely there is to be some compensation or imbalance in the body. So with posture exercises, they are much more simple. They're much more akin to like a yin yoga class or something like that, where you're certainly at the beginning, and certainly while the person's in pain and you're trying to posture detective your way through this puzzle, you are putting people in positions where we are only really testing one part of the body at the time, so we can get really clear answers and so that the person can really focus on their form, so that the rest of their body isn't compensating. So however much I love yoga, I don't believe yoga to be the most easy, it's not the easiest way of reducing pain, because there's often so much going on, so much that the person has to control, and the classes can move quite fast, so they're not quite able to take stock of when I do this, I get this response. When I do this, I get this response. Whereas with posture, everything's a lot slower. There's a lot less happening at once. And so the answers are much clearer. And then that, I guess, kind of segues nicely into what I do now. So I don't work with people one-to-one. I have a membership platform, but in my membership platform, I have created this pathway called the Posture Protocol, which is this like 6-month program to follow, which you do at home on your own, but it has workbooks. And I've broken everything down into it, being like, you do this one exercise this one day. This is what this exercise is doing to your body in terms of joint position and stuff like that. If this exercise makes you feel better, fabulous, do it more, do it again tomorrow, and make a note in your workbook as to which ranges of movement you are challenging, because you need more of that. If it makes you feel worse, ignore it. The next day you'll get another exercise. And we kind of layer upon layer build this journey through the body, which the journey is the same for every person that does it, but the way in which they complete the course is different. It's like a choose your own adventure course, because you're going to be led on slightly different paths depending on what you find out about your body. Sorry, that was real.
No, it's a good answer. And I think anyone going to yoga thinking it's going to necessarily, you're going it to solve problems, it's the wrong reason, I think, initially. And 100% my view is it's far better to move the body than not move the body. And yoga, depending on the class, it's a very good way for you to both build strength and flexibility and mobility, which is not the same as flexibility, just to clarify.
And spirituality.
Well, and spirituality, of course. There's many layers to it, and self-inquiry and all these things. But I think a yoga one-on-one, ideally, unless you're doing it just because you don't really fancy being in a public class, a yoga one-to-one with a good teacher is almost diagnostic. Not diagnosing things that the yoga teacher has no business diagnosing. I'm not a fan of yoga. Well, you've clearly slipped a disc based on that hurting. I'm not a fan of that. But a good yoga teacher should be working with someone, working out, as you describe. Okay, what's happening here? Okay, what happens there? Okay, you're leaning there. What happens if you do that? Okay, well, let's do more of that. And that's what someone should be doing in a one-to-one setting. But it's almost impossible to do that in a vinyasa flow class.
Totally.
Which is why I'm a big fan of experienced yoga students focusing increasingly on understanding yoga poses rather than replicating shapes. I think when you're new to yoga, the shape replication. If you do faster yoga for years, there's an increasing amount of shape replication. If you do certain lineages of yoga, there is shape replication facilitated by the force of a teacher, which I'm not a big fan of. No, I think actually you should be learning what am I trying to do in this pose? What am I trying to lengthen, strengthen? And is the way I'm doing that effectively?
Totally. And you know, that is basically the process of posture. Like that is what this is about, but it is just broken down in a more granular way than most yoga classes are. It really is like, this is what it means and feels like to have your hip flexor firing and hip flexion. Sorry, I'm doing a weird finger thing there. That was my hip moving. This is what it feels like to have the bottoms of your feet cramped because they are plantar flexing. This is what it feels like to feel your shin burn because it's dorsiflexing. And so it's giving people this like language and experience of their body that they've maybe just been like totally unaware of for such a long time because they've become so disconnected because of the sedentary world that we live in. But the reason that, I mean, yoga is just so amazing in so many different ways. And like yoga for me was this gateway drug into movement full stop. It was the gateway drug to this like new life that I have now. You know, I was a very different person 10, 15 years ago. Yoga is incredible. And if it gives people also that initial interest of like, this is what movement feels like. This is how it can benefit me. Yes, my back might be slightly tweaky, but yoga has given me this thing that's so great. It then means that more people will just find more practices like my practice, where it allows them to kind of dig in a bit more about why they might have the pain and that granular detail. But I thoroughly want everybody to do yoga and give it a go.
Just do something, move. Yeah. And I think with yoga especially, like, don't go to one yoga class and think you like it or don't. Like, you need to go to different styles, different teachers. And my view is, don't do the one that feels easy. Like, if it feels easy, maybe question, not question it, but like, if you're doing something that looks good and feels easy, unless you're doing restorative yoga, then I think question it. Let's rewind a little bit, because you said about people kind of getting onto kind of like their, what's comfortable for them, not looking after themselves. I think in one interview, you talked about lack of self-care and how that was kind of subconscious self-harm. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Yeah, okay. So I think that I'm probably going to just repeat maybe what I've said on the whatever interview it was that you listened to. But I think that a lot of the time, people don't make time for themselves because they don't like love themselves enough. I really, and I'm speaking about this like initially from my own personal experience and how I can see that my attitude towards myself has improved so much since finding especially yoga, but other things as well. But I think a lot of the time people think that they, you know, feeling good in yourself has to be trapped in some sort of outcome, be it like I'm on this diet to lose weight, I'm going to the gym to lose weight. It's the things that we often do for ourselves, I think, are coming from quite a punishing place. It's like a self-critical place. I'm not good enough, so I've got to do X, Y, Z, so I'm a better version of myself. And this is the world that we grow up in. It's always about doing more and hustling more and trying harder and sweating and pushing and all that kind of stuff. And therefore, we can make peace with that type of activity because it's generally what everybody else around us is doing. And it's what we've been kind of bred on. But I think things like yoga and posture and meditation and these quieter, more gentle practices can be really confronting for people who have never spent time with themselves in that way. They've never sat quietly with themselves. They've not decided just to sit with their thoughts and not do anything. The reason that so many people find yoga so confronting is because they are not just distracted by chucking weights around on the floor and sweating so hard because they're running so hard. It's the challenge is that you're doing something different with your brain, and it's learning over time that these practices have so much to teach you. And they guide you towards self-love because you realize that you don't have to run a half marathon three times a week to, you know, feel good about yourself. It can just be that the growth that comes with sitting with yourself quietly for a few minutes every day, the growth that comes with realizing, oh, I can just lay on the floor and relax for a few minutes and I feel really nice. And so I think so much of what I do is teaching people that they are worthy and they deserve to look after themselves with these really quiet, beneficial practices that help their body to release tension and let go. And it pushes away from this do more hustle culture that we've all been, in my opinion, like grown up in.
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Because I used to tie my wellness to outcomes. I was the ultra marathon runner, the boxer. I'd be cutting weight for a fight or a like. And speaking from lots of experience, it didn't make me particularly happy. To be fair, my body was in good condition. I think my resting heart rate was 35, resting heart rate at one point, with 5% body fat and 100 kilograms. That was peak. I'm about 100 kilograms.
5% body fat, that is very, very low, isn't it?
Very, very low, but also like mood was very, very low and loneliness was very, very high. at that point in my life. But then I think also people sometimes go the other way. I think self-care is so important, and I think doing it for the sake of doing it is so important, but I think people often switch to the entirely different gear. So I just need it to be about softness entirely, and then of course they're not really looking after themselves, and we need that. We need some hardship, some discipline, but it's almost I think choosing to do a hard thing for the sake of choosing to do a hard thing is really useful for all of us in our lives. Supplemented by softer practices, but I think less and less tying our self-worth to objective outcomes from fitness or wellness, which I see many people doing. And to some degree, I think weirdly increasingly that's coming at a cost to other parts of their life, whether that be like relationships or having children or alike. You know, if people wanted that, then there are these things that can sometimes get in the way. And I'm seeing that kind of a lot in the wellness world, that these outcomes and medals, for instance, from the runs, et cetera, completely blocking people progressing in other areas of their life that actually may give them more.
Well, something along those lines that genuinely makes me feel so sad is how bloody obsessed everybody is with their step count. I'm just like, what is happening? What, like, where is the joy in going for a walk, if you're checking, you're bloody, I hate, sorry if you've got one, I hate smartwatches because I just think they make people obsessed with data rather than intuition and feeling like, am I tired? Have I done enough today? You know, all of this stuff.
In the defense of them, well, not entirely defense, but I don't like all of them. I used to have one that used to send me notifications and I hated it. But what I found is sometimes you do things and it's very hard to measure, like, objectively, is it helping you?
Yes.
So for instance, when I wear, and I've realized this, when I wear red light glasses at night, and I use a device called a NeuroSim, which is a vagus nerve. It's amazing.
My Instagram algorithm's been pumping that to me literally the last weeks, and I thought it looked really good.
Well, feel free to follow my link and use my code for a discount. But I got gifted it, but it is amazing. And
okay,
like,
cool.
Objectively, like, I thought I slept well anyway, but objectively my sleep is better when I do either of those, and it's much better when I do both of them. And I wouldn't necessarily have realized that, I don't think, without it. So I think it can have some benefits. I don't look at step count. I don't look at those kind of things. But sometimes there are some things worth measuring. But I completely agree that there are many people that are obsessed with data and their life is ruled by their watch and they don't actually live life.
I do. Like, I totally agree with what you say, and I'm very interested in the NeuroSim, so I will definitely check that out afterwards. But I don't, maybe I said that a bit too black and white, but it just genuinely makes me feel sad. Makes me feel sad that you've got all of these people at parkrun. I've gone to watch people at parkrun before, and everyone is just, they're just on there looking at their intervals and all this stuff. And I'm like, just run. Have a lovely time on a Saturday morning. Look at these people around you, the countryside around you. Enjoy the feeling in your body. Because by looking at your watch and tracking all this data and making it so, like, robotic and scientific, I believe it's stripping joy away from movement.
It's an interesting challenge we have. We have it in yoga as well, don't we? Because we're trying to, well, as a teacher, we try and teach people to move towards a pose, but at the same time, being completely non-attached to whether they can do the pose or not.
Yeah,
it's constant. We're moving this direction, but I don't care if you can get there or not. It's more just a vague direction. And that's a term I use now. It's a vague direction of travel rather than being a goal in any way. Let's move on slightly to, like, the work stuff and, like, how you had the career change. Like, at what point did you think, less about, I guess, pure posture conversation now, but at what point did you think the transition was worth making to what you do now? And then also, you work with your husband, don't you?
Yes.
And then actually getting them involved in it and working together, and how that ended up being, or not ended up being, how it is.
Okay, totally. So the reason that I got into all of this is, like, to put it in a nutshell, a mental breakdown. So I think loads of people get into something, you know, some massive career change because they've had something drastic happen to them. But I used to live in London. I lived in London for like 5, 6 years, and I was not the person that I am today. I didn't do any exercise, partied constantly, spent all of my money. I drank so much, going on holiday all the time, buying clothes all the time. And I, you know, looking back, it's so obvious that I was just kind of actually just distracting myself and numbing myself from how unhappy I was. I hated living in London. I hated being at a desk. I really felt lost. I didn't know what to do. I didn't want to be there anymore. But people kept telling me, like, oh, to be successful, you have to live in London. And to be successful, you need to have a job like this and you have to grow the ladder. And I just stayed there, numbed out all of my intuition because my body was just like, you need to leave, go to the countryside, do something else. And I was like, oh, no, I can't deal with this. So I just kept hiding from myself until one day, well, led into this, but I started, like, my insomnia really ramped up. I started having panic attacks. I remember once coming out of Oxford Circus tube station and just being like, oh my God, the world was spinning. I felt like I was being strangled. And then one day at work, I had like a dissociative episode, which was genuinely one of the strangest things that's ever happened to me. It's like you fly above your body and I was sort of a couple of meters above myself, wow, looking down myself on my desk. It was so strange. And then I fell back into my body and then broke down in tears. I got signed off for a couple of weeks with anxiety. I went back home to my hometown in the West Midlands, and I saw you're from Birmingham.
I'm from Birmingham, yeah.
I'm from Worcester, so not too far. And so I kind of went back home, tail between my legs, and was just like, What am I doing with my life? You know, I don't want to go back to London. This is just going to happen again. And I think this period of time for me was the first time ever that I listened to what my body was telling me. The disassociation, the panic attacks, the insomnia, all of these things were symptoms, to bring it back to kind of posture and pain. They were symptoms of a greater problem, but they weren't the root cause of the problem. The insomnia wasn't this random thing that had just popped up. It's my body telling me, like, you're stressed. You're not looking after yourself. You have to do something different. So I came back to Worcester. I left London. I felt so depressed because I felt all my friends are climbing the career ladder and being all glam and meeting husbands and stuff like that. And I was just like, oh my God, I'm an absolute loser. I've got nothing going on. I've given everything up. I'm back in my hometown. What do I do? And luckily, at that point, that was when I found yoga. And I just fell head over heels in yoga, in love with yoga. So I hadn't done any exercise, as I said, for like all of my adult life. I was overweight, I was stiff. I couldn't do anything. I remember in my first yoga class, I couldn't kneel on the floor because my like quads were too tight. And I was like, well, everyone else has sat there comfortably. And I was sort of shifting around and I couldn't sit cross-legged. I couldn't do a forward fold. And within a month of doing yoga, my body had changed, but my mindset had changed. And I was like, wait a minute, there are people here who have a career where they're teaching people to move. Like, this seems nice. Like, this, I'm feeling the benefits of this myself. Like, I really like the idea of this. And so I carried on doing yoga, but then I was a bit like, I don't know if my hometown can handle another yoga teacher because it's not a very big city. So I just thought I'm probably not going to make money from doing that and be able to support myself. So I wanted to find something along the lines, but that was a bit different. And then I was sort of searching for various things that were similar, but not quite the same. And then that was when I stumbled across the Egoscue method, which is
Yeah, I didn't
Egoscue.
know how to say it. I wasn't even going to say it. I've got it in my notes, so I'm going to guess how to say that. Yeah, okay.
I've heard all sorts. See, it's the Egoscue method. So I found that. I read the Pain Free by Peter Egoscue book, which is the kind of seminal text. And I was like, this is it. This is it. And I can't explain it other than it was just my gut telling me, this is what you're made to do. Go and do this thing. No one's ever heard of it. It's a niche American modality. You know, it's got some more fame in more recent years because they go on the Tony Robbins circuit. So there's one of the head honchos at Egoscue supports Tony Robbins and
Amazing.
does. So he's trained. He's the same thing as I do. So they've got a little bit more sort of fame now. But no one had done it. But I just thought, this is it. It's that somatic thing that I want to do, helping people move, changing their lives, changing their bodies, changing their perspective. And there's a little bit of a different angle that I can spin on it because, you know, there isn't many people that do it. So that was back in 2018, and I haven't looked back since. And there's not a single day that I miss my old life ever. I
And
never miss my old life.
working with your partner, like how is that? Because I'm sure some for some people that's a dream, for some people that's a nightmare. How is it for you?
It's a mix. I'd be interested to hear what you say about Holly. But it's a mix where it took a while for us to like find our groove, I think, with how it was going to work. But I feel like we're there now. Me and my husband are quite different characters where I'm hyper independent to the point of it probably being a bit toxic, but I'm like, I don't need anybody. I can do all of this myself. And because I've had to do that for the last like 7 years growing my business, I'm very used to just being me, getting my head down, doing stuff. I don't ask people questions. I don't ask people advice. I just do what I want to do. And Ben, I think, needs like more reassurance perhaps than I do. Whereas I'm just like, oh, if I fail, I fail and I'll try again another day. Ben needs a bit more reassurance. But on top of that, because he knows that I've been through everything that he's been through, he will turn to me for advice. And sometimes I'm a bit like, figure it out for yourself. And I'm probably a bit like tough love. I'm not a very sort of nurturing person, maybe. I'm quite like, I just fully believe that everybody has it within them. I really believe that everybody is super powerful and they need to be given the chance to prove themselves without being handheld the whole time. So we did have a little bit of. There was a bit of a struggle there because I wasn't being as helpful perhaps to Ben as he wanted me to be. But I've tried to change that. I've tried to be kinder and more nurturing when he needs my help. And I think he's also learning to kind of stand on his 2 feet a bit more with it. And now it really does work nicely. We kind of take on different roles within the business. So we've got this membership platform called the Posture Squad, and we both teach classes within it. But Ben does like certain things behind the scenes. I do certain things behind the
Nice.
scenes. I have my own podcast. He edits the podcast. He's much more technical,
Nice.
much more confident with anything like that than I am. But it's really nice for him because he's starting to get some more opportunities, like speaking opportunities and corporate gigs. So he's growing his own thing as well. And we do have some days where we work together fully. So tomorrow, I've got one of my members is coming to my studio, and we're going to have a morning together. So we're going to film a routine together that will go on the software so that other people can watch it, but she can watch it. And Ben will help me like record some clips and things like that. He'll be there for that. But then today, for example, my diary has been completely different to his. So I think it's quite nice because we have a balance of
Nice. No, it just sounds good.
being together, yeah, being together a lot sometimes, but not all the
I'm
time.
just conscious of time now. Let's have a little shout out to your book. Your book is coming out in March, I believe. Is that right? Or
Yes,
later?
it is.
Yes, March. And your
It's
book,
March.
give us a quick lowdown of what the book is and how it can help us.
It's called Posture. Oh, it's, no, it's not. It's called Posture. It's not, that's not the name of my book. It's called Posture Power. It's about posture. And basically, in the book, it kind of outlines like what our bodies are designed for. So it gives you that kind of hunter-gatherer overlook of what our bodies are all about and originally. We look at the mismatch between the hunter-gatherer lifestyle, the lifestyle that we're leading at the moment. We look at the most common myths about pain. You know, lots of people will think that because they're getting older, that's why they're getting their pain. And I say, no, that's not why you're getting your pain. It's because your movement patterns are becoming more ingrained, so you've had them for longer. Correlation, not causation. So I kind of dispel a bunch of myths about posture and things that people think to be true that aren't necessarily true at all. And at the end, it moves into like a practical session section with some of my favorite exercises, how you can do the function tests, which we mentioned earlier, and some of the more practical stuff as well.
Nice. And that's pre-order now.
It is pre-order now,
In all
thank
the
you.
normal places. Yeah.
In all the normal
No,
places,
you
yeah.
just said correlation is not causation. I'm so sad.
Yeah.
I've got that sticker on my laptop. What a loser.
Have you?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah. I don't know. It's just a very sad thing.
There's a whole chapter about that in my book,
Oh,
Adam, so
nice.
you'll read it.
Amazing. Thank you so much. Just let us know where people can find you.
Thank you. So yeah, my Instagram is at Posture Ellie, and that's the same as my YouTube. I've got loads of free videos on my YouTube if you want to try them out. And my website is posture-ellie.com. My podcast is Posture Lating, so posture-lating.
Late, I'm
And
sorry, lating.
yeah, as in postulating.
Oh, postulate. Okay.
Little pun there. So postulating, but it's got a hyphen in it. And the book is Posture Power. So if you check me out on Instagram, I've got the links in my bio so you can pre-order there.
Amazing. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me, Adam.
Honestly, unbalanced.